What happens when you study? Well, for those of you who study, you might have an experience like me. I sit in front of a computer and I stare at the screen and I stare out the window and I think about an email I need to reply to, and I get up, go get some food, scroll through Facebook. There are so many distractions around me. And when I finally do manage to write something down, my computer will sometimes crash and I'll lose all the work. It will be gone just like that. And I all feel like I've just wasted my time and there's nothing to show for it. I feel like that way at work sometimes. I mean, work in general, not just this particular job. What happens when you have a big project? Well, you're in a frenzy trying to organize things, get it all done, and you hand it in. The deadline passes and then there is another project before you. And sometimes work can feel kind of pointless. You can feel listless going to work, doing the same things all the time. What happens when you clean? Well, then someone comes over, maybe a child, knocks something over and it's messy again. No matter how much you clean, things will always get messy. There's always clothes that need to be washed or dishes that need to be washed. And it's the same thing over and over again, so it starts to feel kind of numbing. That's if you do clean. I mean, there's all these enticing distractions. You could just sleep in and not clean. You could sit on the couch and watch TV all day and just get used to having a messy place. What happens when you pray? Your thoughts scatter. Your eyelids feel heavy. You think about all the things that you need to do and it feels like you have no time to pray. And if you do try and pray, it can feel static, like you're not even moving, like nothing is changing. Turns out, this is nothing new. Back in 480, a man was born, and he was born into a wealthy Italian family. And as he grew up, he felt restless with his wealth. He felt like it was causing him to waste his life. And he looked at his friends' lives and, you know, some things have never changed. All his friends were out wasting their money, partying. And he wanted something more. So he left it all behind and he lived in a cave by himself for 3 years. And out of that experience, he ended up forming a monastery, a group of people that he gathered who would submit to these rules that they would live by. He became known as Saint Benedict. And Saint Benedict's rules were all about trying to help foster a life that was full of purpose and a life that was centered on God. And so for Benedict, prayer was crucial for this. They would get up 3 a.m. to begin praying. And throughout the day, at regular intervals, they would all stop and pray 8 times every day. But even having set times to pray didn't make praying any easier. Particularly at midday, when it was noon, that was when the monks felt most distracted, when they found themselves staring out the window, when they found themselves feeling hungry and tired and like the day is just going by so slowly. And they wonder, what's the point? Does praying make any difference? Now, it turns out this just wasn't just a comment particularly to Benedict's monastery. You see this quite a lot in writings in the 4th and 5th century. There was this struggle that people would talk about, this listless struggle, which they named the noonday demon or acedia, which means not caring in Greek. There had come a point when the thing that you thought mattered, whether it was study or work or cleaning or prayer, would seem pointless and you'd want to escape it all. You'd fantasize about doing something else, just running away from it all. I'm not sure how much we would fantasize today because we very quickly, I think, give up on things. And we very quickly give in to distractions. We welcome distractions. And there's so many distractions around us. But for these early Christians, they actually thought this was a great temptation. They actually named it one of the 7 or 8 deadly sins. And they urged one another, when they felt like this, to continue to push through until the joy or purpose returned. And I wonder if this is something we need to learn again, that yes, You should expect there will be times when you'll feel distracted. You should expect times when you'll feel listless. The challenge is to keep going. I think Peter experienced a little bit of this as well and has something to teach us about this. Benedict wasn't the first person who ever came up with the idea of having set times to pray. We see glimpses in the Old Testament of Daniel stopping 3 times a day to pray. When the temple was rebuilt, 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. became very popular times when people would gather at the temple and pray as the priests made the necessary sacrifices. And as the Roman Empire kind of grew, many of their cities would have bells that would pass to mark the passing of the day, and people began to use those bells as a reminder for them to stop and pray. Prayer was a habit. It was a habit, a way of life that was ingrained in the lives of the Jewish people. And we see this with Peter. When Peter was in Jerusalem, he prayed at the temple. And when he was outside of the city, he still stopped and prayed. And so we come to Acts 10, and we read how Peter climbs the stairs to the flat roof where he can pray somewhere private. He sits down getting ready to pray. But it is midday and the sun is warm on his head and the ocean breeze has wilted away. And I think Peter experiences what those monks were describing, what we might experience. He is distracted. Acts 10 verse 10. He became hungry and wanted something to eat. I love this detail. He is trying to pray and all he can think about is his stomach. Maybe because I relate so much to it. But to be fair to Peter, Jewish people tended to have a meal mid-morning and then another meal mid-afternoon. So maybe he skipped his mid-morning meal. Maybe he hasn't eaten since the night before. Who knows? And so, you know, when you're out of sync, your body can start to protest. And so his body is telling him he is hungry. But Peter doesn't go and run downstairs and sneak a snack, which I might do. Peter stays. He acknowledges that it is hot. He acknowledges that he is distracted, but he keeps praying. He pushes through it and then falls into a trance. Verse 11. He saw heaven opened and something like a large sheet being let down to earth by its 4 corners. It contained all kinds of 4-footed animals as well as reptiles and birds. Then a voice told him, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." Suddenly there's movement. A white sheet billows out, lays before him like a picnic blanket, and on this picnic blanket is food for him to eat. Well, animals that he is invited to kill and then eat. Now, we might be squeamish at the thought of having to kill animals. I mean, we know that it happens, but it's not exactly pleasant to witness. So maybe we would not want to kill. Or we might be squeamish about what animals are on this sheet. Maybe we would balk at eating, like, I don't know, a lizard or a rat. And maybe we might think, like Peter does, is this a test? Is this the noonday demon at work? If so, Peter's quite clear. He is hungry, but he is not that hungry. And Peter is squeamish for a very particular reason, and it is very different to ours. He knows that he can't eat some of these animals. Now, the Israelites were given very clear food laws from Yahweh about what animals were considered clean and what were considered unclean. So it's clear. Camels and pigs are out. Sheep and ox are okay. Fish are clean, but nothing else from the sea. Some birds are considered unclean. Birds like vultures and eagles. Insects are out, but locusts are okay. Lizards and rats are considered unclean, and so on and so on. If you're interested in this, you can actually read about this. It goes into quite some detail in places like Leviticus 11. And the point of these laws was to mirror God's holiness. In the way that they ate, they were to eat in such a way that people would notice that they were different. Holiness often means separate, different. And so the Israelites were to live and, in this case, eat in such a way that the nations around them would be like, oh, that's strange. They're not like us. They're different. They don't eat the same food that we eat. Because as we know, food can be such a strong identity marker. And so Israel was to be a little bit unusual in what it ate so that they would be showing the nations that they worshipped a holy God, a God who's different to other gods. Imagine the backlash Peter would face if he suddenly broke those laws. Maybe it's hard for us to imagine the backlash, but someone who might have understood it a little bit is a person named Jordan Younger. We might not have laws from God, but there is a growing interest in what's been called the clean food movement. There's a growing interest in trying to work out what is clean food or good food and what is not. So for instance, you know, whole food is often considered clean, good, and processed food is considered bad, or meat is often considered not particularly good, unless maybe it's organic or wild, then it might be considered good. Jordan Younger was part of this clean food movement, and it's a movement, I think, that provokes a lot of interest because I think a lot of people are trying to work out what does it look like to be healthy? What does it look like to care for our planet? And so she promoted an all-raw plant-based diet. And she had a large following on the internet. She had a blog, Instagram. And so she would write recipes, share recipes, and she'd post rather attractive pictures of herself. And she became known as the blonde vegan. I mean, food is an identity marker. This was part of her identity. It wasn't just about trying to be healthy and look after the planet. It was also about signaling to the world who she was. But then her hair started to fall out and her period stopped and her skin began to turn a slight orange colour, and she in the end sought out professional help, saying, like, what are these distractions? What do they mean? And she was actually diagnosed with a kind of a new eating disorder, which can sometimes emerge when we become very restrictive and view food in very black and white, good and bad categories. So she had to get some psychological help. And she also needed help with maybe just opening up her diet a little bit. So she started to eat things like fish. But one of her greatest fears was, well, what are people, what is my community going to think when I tell them? Because food is such an identity marker, sometimes we can make really strong judgments on what people eat. So she posted a blog basically outlining what I've been sharing. And it turns out she was right to fear the backlash. There was this terrible backlash against her, with people calling her a stupid, fat lard, someone who's not strong enough to be truly clean. And even at the most extreme, like, she received death threats. That is what Peter would have feared. And so Peter stands firm. And he pushes back and he says, verse 14, "Surely not, Lord," Peter replied. "I have never eaten anything impure or unclean." He refuses. He thinks he must have misunderstood God. I mean, after all, it is the middle of the day and he's hot and he's hungry. This is just a distraction that he just needs to push through. But then God speaks again and rebukes Peter, saying, verse 15, "Do not call anything impure that God has made clean." Since God raised Jesus from the dead, everything has been spinning for Peter. I mean, firstly, he got to see Jesus again and interact with him and have conversations with him. And then 40 days later, Jesus disappeared into the heavens. Then Peter and the disciples gathered and prayed, and they saw tongues of fire descending above people's heads. They saw people being able to speak in different languages, miraculous healings, the crowds coming and putting their trust in Jesus. But he also saw persecutions. His friend was stoned to death. And just as he begins to settle into this new rhythm, this new way of life, just as he's Going around the coastal region, trying to see how these new followers of Jesus are going, trying to encourage them and help them as they form these little new church communities. Just as he's settling into the daily habit of prayer and feeling distracted, God turns that distraction into a disruption and reminds Peter, this is a new time. When God raised Jesus from the dead, the whole order of creation was disrupted, so much so that the effects are still being felt months later. Jesus' death and resurrection transforms everything, including the way Peter views food. Now, three times God repeats this message to Peter, so this is pretty important. But what does it mean? Why is it so important? Peter doesn't really know. The sheet billows back up, disappears into the heavens, and Peter is left trying to figure out what it means. He's alone on the rooftop, sweat sliding down his back, still hungry, but now confused. It is much harder to pray when God actually interrupts and speaks. I mean, you think distractions are hard? No. Being disrupted by God is harder because Peter knows that God wants a response, but what response? He puzzles this vision that he has seen over and over in his mind. Nothing. He doesn't get it. And then, after this dazzling and bizarre vision, the Spirit of God speaks to Peter and says, verse 19, Simon, three men are looking for you, so get up and go downstairs. Do not hesitate to go with them, for I have sent them. Three strangers have turned up at the house, and so Peter begins to think, well, these visitors must be related to this vision I've just seen. But again, why is this vision so important? Peter has dealt with many strangers. He has been sharing the gospel to strangers. He has been eating with strangers. He's been praying for strangers. I mean, not that long ago, he just went into a dead woman's house and prayed and she rose back to life. He hurries down the stairs and then he stops. Oh, that's why the vision. These strangers are not Jews. All the people that he has been interacting with up until this point have been Jewish, but here are strangers who he can tell straight away by the clothes they wear that they are Romans, and not just Romans, they are part of Rome's army. And they come up to him and they say, verse 22, we have come from Cornelius the centurion. He is a righteous and God-fearing man who is respected by all the Jewish people. A holy angel told him to ask you to come to his house so that he could hear what you have to say. Not only has God spoken and given this vision to Peter, he's also disrupted Cornelius' life. This is important. And it's not in the end so much about what Peter can and cannot eat. This is about God wanting even these people to know Jesus. People who clearly are not Jews, who don't have the same food customs, who some would call unclean, but not God, not anymore. So with these clear signs, Peter invites these strangers into their house and they share a meal. Almost unheard of, Jew and Gentile eating together. This is a major turning point for Peter and for the early church. As I said, up until now, they've been telling the good news of Jesus, healing in Jesus' name to Jews. But Jesus is good news to all people groups. And the book of Acts wants to make it clear that this realization only comes not because of the disciples, but because of God. It was as Peter was praying that God revealed to him this disruptive, life-changing truth. If there'd been no prayer, there'd be no vision. It'd be a lot harder to hear the Spirit, and if God had never intervened, I mean, it's quite possible that you and I wouldn't be here, that this would have remained a small Jewish sect. That is why prayer is so foundational to all that we are and all that we do, because God is the one who shakes us up. God is the one who takes us out of our comfort zones. God is the one who reminds us that He has a heart for all people. And it can be easy to forget when life becomes ho-hum. I mean, even those people who go overseas to work as cross-cultural workers will speak about sometimes feeling like it's pointless, sometimes feeling like prayer is boring, or that God must feel bored when he listens to us. There was a man working for Global Interaction who actually shares that, and he said he was challenged as he was serving in Southeast Asia. The call to prayer reverberates out from the mosques 5 times a day. It is a constant reminder that people surrendered to God have a life that is centered on prayer, time with God. Listening to the call, there's nowhere here where you can miss it, is slowly working towards a change in me. 5 times a day, I'm reminded that I must continually surrender to God if I'm to have any influence here as a follower of Jesus. The cross-cultural worker is learning the value of set prayer, the value of using his body to pray, and he prays through the Lord's Prayer. 5 times a day, he prays even when he is distracted, trusting that God is present. Sometimes prayer can feel pointless, until it is not. Peter didn't have visions every time he prayed. In fact, this is the only vision that is recorded to us that Peter has in the New Testament, but it is such a big vision. It is a vision that expands who God is and what God is doing, and expands the role of the church and what the church is called to do and be. Regardless of how you feel, don't give up on prayer. Make it a habit, a way of life like Peter. I don't naturally pray in the middle of the day. I don't naturally even say grace after every meal. I didn't grow up with it. And so sometimes people will eat and I will eat and I realize people are waiting to stop and say grace. But I'm learning the value of set times to pray, because it's only then I have a better idea of, you know, to listen to God, to see what God is doing in this place and around the world. What happens when we pray? Well, we never quite know what happens, how God might at work. We might find ourselves sitting and having a meal with strangers, might find ourselves being called to share the gospel overseas. What we can expect is that God will disrupt our lives in ways that we never imagined. So the challenge this month of May, is to pick the worst time of the day to pray, midday, and let's try and pray for this month of May. Stop and pray and see what God might do. If you want, there's Global Interaction prayer guides. If you want to be guided in your prayers, we can be praying, or you can just pray whatever is on your heart. But let's make it a habit. Stop and pray, and see how God might respond.